Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are going to talk about the hottest holiday toys going back 100 years. We'll talk about that, and we got some holiday food stuff to talk about as well as we get ready for Christmas. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you'd like to get a hold of us. 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Lots to talk about this morning after a couple of weeks of drought as far as like movie releases go, but the next 3 weeks or the next week and a half or so is going to be really busy. And so we have Eric Childress and Colin Suter. They join me every Monday morning to review the new movies, and let's bring the guys in. Here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And there's Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
Okay, well, let's get started because we got a lot to talk about. Eric, why don't you start us off with Mortal Engines?
Okay, well, as you might have seen the advertisements for this, it's being advertised as from the makers of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that's partially true. Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens wrote the screenplay for the film, which is based on a series of books set sometime in the future after a nuclear war where the cities of the world, the surviving cities at least, have been basically put onto, recreated as sort of moving targets, if you will. They're basically, you know, cities on wheels. And you have, you know, this basic warring factions, one side or the other, you know, the power mongers. People are trying, certain people are trying to keep the historical artifacts alive. Thaddeus Valentine, played by Hugo Weaving, is supposedly at the forefront of that, but he might have more malicious intentions, especially as in regards to a masked assassin played by Hera Hilmar, who has designs on taking him out. And when she is discovered, when she tries an assassination plot, she's chased off of one of the cities, and there's another young man who doesn't believe her at first why she might want to kill this great man. But when he confronts Thaddeus about what her intentions might actually be, well, he throws him off a balcony, and the two of them team up to find out what the truth of her story is, and restore some balance to the power order or whatever the hell is going on. I honestly did not know what the hell was going on during this movie. It was directed by Christian Rivers, who is a visual effects creator supervisor who worked on all of the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films. So Peter Jackson clearly felt he was up to the task, and he certainly is in regards to the special effects, because if there's one thing this movie has going for it, when it does put in the time to, you know, concentrate on them, the special effects are, you know, pretty spectacular. They're very, it's very interesting to look at, as crazy as some of these, the ideas behind this movie actually are. It's amazing to me that, you know, after a nuclear war, you think more Thunderdome than you think people that have been able to cobble together all the pieces of scrap metal and create, you know, roving cities and things like that. It's just, it's kind of just hard to believe. We're not exactly sure how far in the future this actually is. But those elements are still pretty striking to look at. And at times, I just kind of wish the movie had been put on mute just so I could just kind of watch this as a silent movie, perhaps, and just kind of, you know, kind of get an idea, you know, just soak in the, you know, the visuals, sort of like a, in like a Fritz Lang kind of way, because I didn't care one iota what anyone was fighting for, who the characters were. The guy that plays this, the guy that helps the assassin, imagine if you take away all the ounce of personality that Eddie Redmayne has, that's what this guy is like spending 2 hours with. Hugo Weaving doing his thing. He's not even that interesting a villain this time around. I mean, there are cyborgs and other assassins, and it just plots cobbled together from, you know, a tons of futuristic cyberpunk type stuff. It's like a blend of like the worst instincts of the Wachowskis in their later efforts. The movie, as visually striking as it could be at times, really just kind of put me to sleep in between all of that, and that's quite often.
Yeah, this is bad, man. like you, Eric, I had no idea what the hell was going on. I couldn't follow it. I didn't care. I thought the lead was weak. What am I quoting? Glengarry Glen Ross there for a second.
What's going on there? You're weak.
So, and Hugo Weaving, shockingly, Hugo Weaving plays a villain. That's a shock. That's a real shock. Mm-hmm. And he's just going through the motions here. And, you know, you did mention the Wachowskis, but, you know, I guess, you know, it could fall under that kind of umbrella. But I find the Wachowskis, and I know that everybody has kind of fallen off the wagon with those guys, except me. I still like what they're doing. And I guess it could fall into that category, but it doesn't have nearly as many ideas as anything the Wachowskis would do. I just didn't care. It's long. It's over 2 hours, and visually it's striking. I mean, they clearly spent, how much money did they spend on this movie?
It's a $100 million production.
Yeah. And it's not going to make that back, that's for sure.
Not in the U.S., at least.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, it looks good. Special effects are pretty impressive. But, man, there's nothing else going on. Absolutely nothing else. And, I mean, my butt was numb a half an hour into the movie. I just I just didn't care. So, anyway, on Mortal Engines. All right. Colin?
Yep.
Why don't you tell us about Vox Lux?
Well, this stars Natalie Portman as a pop diva, but the movie starts with her as a teenager who bears witness to a high school shooting in the late 90s, and now that event has kind of transformed her life. After she sings at a memoriam, she starts to become a bit of a teen sensation, along with her sister, who's kind of protective of her, but she eventually becomes a superstar. And the film touches on a few other cultural moments throughout her career that leads up to present day, but the real story in the film is her relationship with her teenage daughter, who's played by Rafi Cassidy, who also plays the teenage version of Portman's character early in the film, so she has a dual role here. And, of course, their relationship is rocky at best. But Portman's character has spent a good part of her youth and her entire adult life in the spotlight. And she, you know, has to answer to her publicists and managers, played by Jude Law and Jennifer Ailey, and journalists who ask tough questions that she thinks are out of line. And that's a normal day for her as she goes out on this world tour in support of her new album. And Vox Lux is the name of one of her albums that she made. I should also mention that the movie has a third-person narrator played by Willem Dafoe. And that kind of gives the movie this kind of element of that you're participating in this kind of historical fictional watermark in American culture with this character and what she represents. It's kind of gives the movie a little bit of self-importance that is a little too grating at times. The movie presents itself as this very culturally significant story, and even the movie adheres to that by giving, you know, chapter stops and an opening credit scene that's really closing credits and doing all these big directorial flourishes to get our attention and to really sit up and you know, pay attention to what a significant piece this is. But by the end, I didn't really feel like anything was accomplished with that. I felt like this was an exercise in watching a lot of great actors, you know, play a lot of juicy roles, especially Portman. This is a very juicy role for her, a very showy role. And I think she acquits herself to it mostly quite well. There are times when I, you know, thought it was a little overdone, but that might be the point. This character spends a lot of time in front of cameras and spends a lot of time probably, you know, acting for people. Even though she's not an actress, she's a singer, but there's a lot of acting that goes along in that. So maybe it's not Portman, maybe it's just the character and her choice to play it that way. It's not a boring movie. Certainly, this is a movie that is rich with, it's full of life and tragedy and big emotional moments. But I was really waiting for something to connect it all together, and by the end of the movie, you do get to see Natalie Portman on stage as the pop diva. In performance, and I was afraid the movie was going to sidestep that, but I was, you know, it was nice to see it happen because I think Portman does very well in that. But it doesn't add up to much, and it feels like it wants to be. And this is going to be maybe a pretentious thing to say, but there's a Salman Rushdie book that is along these same lines called The Ground Beneath Her Feet. And it felt like this movie wanted to be a movie version of that book. It really kind of has a lot of parallels to it, but without really the courage or the wit to really pull it off. So it falls kind of short for me. There's a lot of things I do like about it, but by the end, I felt like there was something really missing in the narrative to really give it to make it truly memorable.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Colin are going to hang on. That was Colin's review of Vox Lux. We'll find out what Eric thought of it and what I thought of it after we take a break for the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And it also means that it's movie review time. Before the break, Colin Suter told us all about Vox Lux, Natalie Portman's new movie, and now let's find out what Eric thought of it and what I thought of it. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Eric, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm right with Colin on this one. When I saw the movie at Toronto this year, I mean, self-importance is kind of an understatement. Because like Colin, you're kind of waiting for the entire movie to sort of, you know, come to its point. You know, I mean, the movie, you know, opens with this really horrific school tragedy, and the whole movie seems to be trying to make a statement about exploiting tragedy and sort of the cult of healing that can come as a result of that sometimes, and how would then we forget about it, you know, just as easily in the name of distraction and entertainment. And, you know, so I'm sitting there like, okay, this is clearly what this movie is trying to go for. But by the end, it just seems like it's just kind of all lost. And it's like one of those movies that is kind of pointing the finger at you. Like, if you don't get what I'm saying, then it's on you. And it's not my fault that you don't get what I'm saying. And that, you know, that's, you know, that's beyond pretentious and self-importance. The movie was directed and I think written also by Brady Corbett, who's an actor who's now directed a couple of really, really ambitious films. I mean, this movie is nothing if not ambitious in what it's attempting to try to say, I think, but ultimately doesn't really get around to saying it. And there's little more to say about it other than that. I mean, I think the acting is really good in the movie. I think Natalie Portman is terrific once she finally enters the movie, which is more than 50 minutes into it. I think Jude Law is really funny at times in it. And I like this actress, Raffi Cassidy, for a few years now. I think the gimmick of having her play the young Natalie Portman and the daughter, I think that doesn't really work. It's more of a distraction than anything else. But, yeah, so by the end, I was just kind of like, yeah, okay, great, nice try, move on.
Okay, I think I liked it more than you guys did. It does have an air of pretentiousness to it, but I think there's some really provocative stuff in the movie, and I think it does make a pretty important statement about exploitation. But the key to this movie to me is Portman. I think Portman's great in it. Like it's a really, really good performance, and Jude Law is quite good too. I agree with you about the stunt casting. It is a distracting element to the movie, but overall, I was entertained by this movie, and I thought it was interesting. But I think it's propelled almost singularly by Portman. I think she's tremendous in this movie. It's one of my favorite Natalie Portman performances of all time. So I'm going to recommend it. You know, it's not a perfect movie. There are flaws to it, and it's a little grating here and there. But overall, I like the statement, I like the style, and I really, really like Natalie Portman. So I'm recommending Vox Lux almost entirely because of Natalie Portman, which I think is great in it. Okay, all right. Let's see, Eric. Why don't you tell us about Ben is Back?
Okay, well, this is the latest film from Peter Hedges. Gave us Pieces of April, and the movie stars Julia Roberts as a mother and a family who returns home. It's like the day before Christmas. Returns home with her family and finds that her eldest son is waiting for them outside the house. This is not a normal thing because he's actually been away in rehab, and we don't know all the circumstances regarding this, but the rest of the family outside of Julia Roberts' mother is not particularly happy to see him. They're very cautious about even letting him in the house, letting him spend any specific time with them. Mom is a lot more forgiving at first and is just really happy to have her son and potentially have him there for Christmas, even though, you know, he says that he's been giving time off from his rehab stay. We're not exactly sure, you know, if he can be trusted at all. So the family manages to sort of solve their differences and you know, allow him to stay under very strict guidelines. And hopefully they can have a nice Christmas together. But the film then, you know, kind of shifts tones and discovers that there's actually going to be a lot more trouble over the holiday because Ben is back. And this leads to kind of a split movie in a way, where the second half sort of involves the sort of the converging of the past and the present and exactly a lot of the details about why, you know, he went to rehab and you know, why it's probably best that he's actually not around the family for the holidays. Okay, so, you know, this is not the first parent wants to help their, addicted child through some things that we've had this season. We've had Beautiful Boy with Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet, and I saw both of these movies at Toronto, not too far apart. I saw this one second. And to me, this is kind of a movie split into two parts, and it was kind of an odd experience, actually, because I mean, the movie starts, it's kind of following the kind of routine that we expect a movie like the story it's trying to tell, kind of going through the motions. You know, Roberts is really good. I forgot to mention Lucas Hedges plays Ben in the movie, and he's also quite good. But it's sort of, you know, kind of familiar. But, you know, as the sort of the first half of the movie goes along, it gets to a point where, like, I felt like, okay, well, this would actually make a nice ending to the story. And I didn't even realize that we were only halfway through the movie, because it actually felt like kind of a natural kind of way to end the movie, is a scene in a church that I think, you know, would have sufficed as a good ending to a very short movie. But then the movie shifts gears in the second half, and it becomes this sort of this all-night journey through his past, and that stuff felt a lot more cliched than the setup of the movie, to the point that it felt far more phony. It felt far more routine. It felt scripted, and I couldn't really. I wasn't willing to follow it along this path. There's a scene at a mall at a food court that actually made me laugh out loud in the theater, involving someone on an elevator just happens to see Ben across the way, and that scene actually made me laugh out loud. I thought it was pretty ridiculous. But just the second half of the movie, I think it just kind of betrays what I think was gearing up to be a nice story about acceptance and about trying to mend these wounds within this family. So I think the first half of the movie works, and you get to the church scene. If you leave after that church scene, I think you've seen a pretty decent short movie. If you stay to the end, I think that you're going to see how much better Beautiful Boy did all of this.
Okay. All right. Colin?
I liked it more than Eric did. I was with this movie, really. It didn't seem to me like it was two halves. I mean, I get where you're coming from with that, but I don't think I would have bought it if it was just a nice story that ended at the church, because this is something that, cripples a lot of families, and it takes, almost, decades to bring things back to normal, if you're lucky to get it back to normal or any semblance of normalcy. So I think, it's the first half is stronger, but I think the second half, needs to have something there to give this more of a conflict and more of a balance to, what families really go through with this stuff. And I think mostly the second half works because of Julia Roberts. I think she gives a really terrific performance here. There's a lot of scenes where she kind of has to lie to the rest of her family about what's going on. And, she's almost making her complicit in all of this. And, you kind of see where a little bit of her son's behavior comes from and how he has to sort of manipulate the family into believing what he's trying to sell them. And I found that conflict, that dynamic, very compelling. This is an interesting movie from a director of Pieces of April, because that took place on a holiday about a fractured family trying to, with one member trying to bring everyone back together and hold it together if possible. And this movie kind of covers those same themes, although from a different angle and with a different tone and a different perspective. But it's I think it's an interesting return to that territory. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect film. Yeah, I agree. The scene in the mall is kind of silly. There's moments like that are, just a little too, a little too convenient, a little, kind of elicits a bit of an eye roll. But based on the performances and some of the direction here, I think it's a good film. Is it as good as Beautiful Boy? No, but I think on its own, it works. And I was actually very moved by a scene that happens early in the film in a cemetery. Even though I had seen part of it in the trailer, it still really got to me. So I'm actually recommending this one.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin are going to hang on. We're going to take a break. Come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Ben is Back. And that's coming up right here on 720 WGN. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Also, we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. We are in the middle of the movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to review the new movies. And we got a bunch to review this morning. So let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll tell you what I thought of Ben Is Back. This is the latest movie with Julia Roberts, Lucas Hedges, Courtney Vance. I'm leaning more towards Colin on this one. There are things about this movie that I really, really loved, particularly the performances. I think all the performances are good. It's not now. Again, I would say that it's not nearly as good as Beautiful Boy, which is a movie that I just thought was fantastic. But I think there's a lot of elements here that work, and I think it's a really a complicated and kind of a wonderful performance by Julia Roberts, hanging this whole thing together. The second half of the movie isn't quite as strong as the first, but I was with it all the way through. I cared about what was going on. I was moved by it. And I think, again, you know, like the last movie we were talking about, Vox Lux, it might not be the greatest movie in the world, but it was propelled by some good performances, particularly by Natalie Portman. Same thing here. Lucas Hedges, man, he's a terrific actor. He's a really, really good actor. His dad wrote and directed this and clearly wrote it for him. And it does explore some of the similar themes that Pieces of April explored. I think Pieces of April is a much better movie. But overall, I found this movie to be compelling, and it's mostly because of the central performances. It does get things right, and it does get things wrong. But overall, I'm recommending it, and I think the story is pretty compelling, and the acting is really terrific. So I'm recommending Ben Is Back. All right, let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about Shoplifters?
All right, well, this is a film from Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. I think I'm pronouncing that right. He directed a movie called After the Storm last year, and a few years ago he did a film called Like Father, Like Son, not to be confused with the Kirk Cameron Dudley Moore movie. And this is about a family of people who are on the outskirts of normal society. They don't have a lot of money. The parents take really odd jobs, if they actually work at all. And the kids, everyone actually, has taken to shoplifting to get food on the table and to make ends meet. And now they've just taken in a little girl who they learn comes from a bad household. They find her, they take her in, and just make her one of them. And as the girl assimilates to this new life, we start to discover things about this family that was never made clear from the outset. Where they came from, what they've done in the past, who everyone is. And the family with the kid, where the kid came from, they come forward in the media and present themselves as loving parents who are looking for their kid. So now this family has to deal with that. So this is the director of this movie is, you know, his style is very, very slow, very contemplative, and doesn't really judge his characters. And it takes a while, for you to see really what's going on here. So it requires a little bit of patience on the viewer. It is full of wonderful little life vignettes, wonderful little moments that, are big for the characters, but are going to seem small for the audience. The last half hour of this movie is a real heartbreaker. When you start to learn more about what's going on, and I was really just
so riveted by this movie. The performances across the board are fantastic. The kids are great. The grown-ups are, you know, you kind of do, I mean, you really are invested in them. You really do want them to kind of succeed at this in a weird way, you know, in taking this girl in and not get caught, because you do get a sense of the life that she came from. But then the life that she has right now is certainly less than ideal, but maybe it's better, but maybe it's not. And you're really kind of torn throughout the whole film with all these characters and all these different situations. And I think Corrieta does, you know, accomplishes something pretty amazing in the last half hour of this movie. Really kind of pulls the rug out from under the audience in a way that isn't jarring in tone, and it isn't, you know, take you out of the movie. It's not like this big, fantastic twist that, like, shifts the whole perspective of everything. I mean, it does shift the perspective, but not in a way that is... you know, that feels like you're watching a different kind of movie. It's really, it's all part of a beautiful whole. And, I really can't recommend it enough. It's a really fantastic film. And it's playing at the Music Box right now.
Okay.
So definitely check it out.
Okay. That's Shoplifters, which is playing at the Music Box. Highly recommended by Colin. All right. None of us saw Mary Queen of Scots. How'd that happen? I mean, why?
Good question.
I can't figure out why I didn't see a Saoirse Ronan movie. That just seems weird to me. I didn't have.
That's the weirdest part. Yeah.
That's so. Anyway, but I'm gonna. I will catch up with it because I won't miss anything that she's in. So.
I think it's precisely the kind of film that the studio wants us to see.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, this is the.
And they didn't let us.
This is the time of year that they release this kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
But, you got two of last year's Best Actress Oscar nominees in the film. So, we'll see how that works out. Mary Queen of Scots, but none of us saw it. So, all right. Eric, tell us about The Mule.
Okay. Well, this is the latest film from director Clint Eastwood, and the first time he's been on screen since 2012's Trouble with the Curve. And this is based on a true story of a man who has worked in horticulture and sort of worked in Peoria, Illinois, if I'm not mistaken. Kind of, you know, put everything into his work. He traveled a lot. He is big in his own horticulture community, but neglected his family quite often. As a point is made very early on, he even misses his own daughter's wedding, who's actually played by Allison Eastwood in the film. We flash forward a dozen years, and he's sort of lost his business and even lost his home where they worked out of. And he is someone at his granddaughter's engagement party, sees he has a truck, and he's kind of low-key off the radar, and offers him a job. And unbeknownst to him, it's a job running drugs for the local cartel. Shows up at a garage. They give him a phone. They put a package in the back of his truck, and all he has to do is drive it to another location, and they take the merchandise. He takes the money, and so it goes. There's a new a DEA agent in town, played by Bradley Cooper, and the DEA is not having a good time with busts lately. He has teamed up with Michael Pena to try and find some angle to nail the cartel and nail some of their shipments, this puts these two characters on a path towards one another. So this is kind of a,
okay.
a curious...
Eric, hang on.
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a break. All right, and we've heard about the plot of The Mule. It's Clint Eastwood's latest movie. We'll find out what Eric thought of it and what I thought of it as well. That's right here on 720 WGN. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we are going to talk about the most popular holiday toys from the past 100 years, and we also have some other holiday topics that we're going to get to. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, the movie review is with Eric and Colin are happening right now, and we're in the middle of reviewing this latest Clint Eastwood movie, which stars Clint, and it's called The Mule. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, well, Eric, you told us a little bit about the plot of The Mule. Now tell us what you thought of it. Yeah.
Well, I was saying that this was kind of a curious entry into this particular season. It was only announced on the schedule, a few months ago. I think maybe late summer, early fall, that Warner Brothers put this movie on the schedule. And anytime you announce a Clint Eastwood movie in December, people are already thinking, potential awards candidate. But it was really interesting that Warner Brothers, not only did they not have it on their award site for the year, but it seemed like they were just kind of going out of their way not to even show this film to any press whatsoever. It wasn't until a number of emails and phone calls, I guess, that there was even a screening set up late this week here in Chicago. Up until Tuesday afternoon, it didn't even look like the movie was even going to screen. And then people started seeing the movie, and there was a lot of positive feedback about it. For me, I think the movie is kind of sitting right on the fence for me. It's a competently made movie. Eastwood, seems, with the exception of the 1517 to Paris earlier this year, when he's making a movie like this and he's just kind of telling his story from A to C, he is reasonably successful at that. He shoots quick, he knows what he wants, and he's gonna, just kind of get it over as quick as possible. Not that this is a quick movie, this is a 2-hour film. I think it's a movie that has a lot of individual scenes that work on their own. But I think it's also, possessing a really bad screenplay by Nick Schenck, who also wrote or co-wrote Gran Torino. I think this is a movie that is trying, it kind of skirts around certain issues with the story. It's really trying to lay home the whole family aspect. This seems like ever since Fast and the Furious put that word family out there, every movie is trying to just shove that down our throats, from Bohemian Rhapsody to this, that family is the most important thing, and everything I've done in my life is leading, has to lead back to family, otherwise it's all a failure. Okay, great, we got that. And we see a lot of that in this movie. But then there are also aspects to it also that, like, a guy running drugs for the cartel, whether he knew it or not, at first, he gets to start liking it and then starts doing some positive things for his community as well with the money he's getting. The movie doesn't really seem to have a point of view towards that. It doesn't really, the whole concept of people having to do morally questionable things to do good things in society, I think, is a really fascinating topic, but this movie doesn't seem to really want to tell, have anything to say about that. It's just kind of like, well, he just did this and then he helped some people out. Okay, great. But, he was also, part of him kind of enjoying this, the newfound attention that he was getting. This is an old timer set in his old ways, and there's some really awkward racial stuff that occurs in the movie, and, a scene involving lesbians on bicycles that, like, okay, I guess we're just trying to say that old timers are set in their ways and they're not going to change, because there's a lot of you know, you old, you young people on your phones today type stuff in this movie, and you can't change, how your daddy never teach you to change a tire, all that kind of stuff in it. Great. But there are individual scenes with Clint that are very good. You know, I actually kind of liked the complicated relationship that he was having with the son of the drug cartel leader. I thought that, or the at least the, you know, it was kind of a adopted son of the cartel leader. I thought that that was kind of interesting, but at one point that just kind of goes away. It doesn't really build up a significant amount of tension throughout. The later scenes of the movie just don't have the kind of impact that that we hope that's kind of building towards something in the way that he was able to do so well with, say, like A Perfect World many years ago. You know, but Clint's, you know, gives a good performance in the film. I think there, you know, Cooper is fine. Andy Garcia has one particularly really funny line that is so funny that you kind of go, then you kind of wince at afterwards. So I'm like, by the end of it, I was just kind of like, you know, I didn't hate it, but I think that there's so much more that could be told with the story if Clint wasn't just so rushed to make it, and if he had a better screenplay in his hand. So I'm not recommending it, but I can't give it a full-on endorsement entirely either.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of in the same camp. I was underwhelmed by a lot of this movie, and it was real. It's a real repetitive movie. I mean, I understand that, you know, they want to, they, you know, like they, and for each time that he does a run, they show, you know, what number run it is, like it's the 10th run or the 11th run or anything like that. But there's not a real, there's not a whole lot of variation, you know, of what's going on in the movie. And there's very little, if it, I mean, there's a scene where there is a pretty great scene early in when he discovers that he's in fact, because at first he doesn't look in the bag, he doesn't see what's going on, but then he sees that he's actually hauling cocaine, and it just so happens that a state trooper with a dog shows up, and that's really the only time that the movie ever really has any kind of suspense. You know, Bradley Cooper, Michael Pena, I think, you know, that stuff I think is funny, but you know, you never really, there's never really a sense of like them really wanting to track this guy down. There's a, and then like not knowing who this, they know that there's a guy hauling drugs, they know that there's a mule, but they don't know who he is. And obviously they don't think, you know, a 90-year-old guy like Clint Eastwood would be your target. And in fact, there's a really good scene in a Waffle House with Bradley Cooper and Clint Eastwood, and neither of them, you know, like he knows that he's a DEA agent, Clint does, but of course Bradley Cooper has no idea that this 90-year-old guy in this Waffle House is indeed the mule that they're looking for, because they went after a different guy who would fit the description more at this hotel earlier. You know, so that's really nice, but there's never really a sense of suspense. I mean, even all the way up until the end, like there doesn't seem to be urgency on the part of Bradley Cooper on his end. It just seems superfluous, you know. But in the positive side, I think there's a lot of really, there are really individual moments in this movie that really, really work. And Clint, I think Clint's very good in it. I think it's a really good performance, and at times a very funny performance. There are a lot of laughs in this movie, basically generated by some of the ridiculous stuff that comes out of Clint Eastwood's mouth in the movie. But you know, but it never, you know, like the family stuff at the end where he sort of kind of goes back to the family. Diane Weiss plays his ex-wife in the movie. And as you mentioned, his daughter is played by Allison Eastwood. And there's a lot of conflict between them. And, you know, all that stuff towards the end where he's trying to make amends. It doesn't, there's nothing in the screenplay that builds up to any kind of sympathy that we could have for this character and what he's gone through. And it just kind of like bops all over the place. Like the first, like, you know, 15 minutes of the movie, there's so much stuff kind of thrown at us. You learn who this guy kind of is and what he is, and what he is thought of by his peers and the people that he works with, or, you know, or in that horticultural world. But you barely get a grasp on what's going on with his family. You know, the next thing you know, they're just yelling at him for showing up at a wedding rehearsal or a party, and you don't really understand. I mean, the conflict is just kind of set up, and then that's it. And then he decides to take the gig, and then basically just goes on these repetitive runs, having some interesting conversations and some interesting relationships with some of the guys that he's working with, you know. And they tend to, at first, they think he's just this old goof, but then they like him, and that works up a sort of relationship. And then there's an extended sequence where he goes to Mexico and hangs out with, the head of the cartel, played by Andy Garcia, who I think is really, really good in this and has a lot of fun. And then it just has like this crazy weekend where he's sleeping with two women. You know, he's 90 years old. He's got 20-year-old women rolling around.
I gotta say, Nick, I was not expecting multiple threesomes in this movie.
And there are. And it's like, good for Clint. All right.
Yeah, it's Clint the director was taking care of Clint the actor in this movie.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So, but overall, it doesn't. There's no emotional payoff at the end, and there should be. You know, and I just didn't care. And I'm with you. I'm with you, Eric. You know, we all know that Clint's reputation is that I want to make a movie fast. I want to get it done. I want to be on the golf course by 10 a.m. And that really shines through in this. I mean, that's very, very clear that he shot this thing as quickly as possible and gave very little direction to anybody.
Right.
And whatever in terms of performances, whatever stands out was brought to the game by these people, because Bradley Cooper is really fun in it, and so is Michael Pena. Lawrence Fishburne doesn't have much to do, but overall,
no.
You know, overall, eh, you know. So.
Yeah, it's just the whole movie. I kept thinking about how good The Old Man and the Gun was.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, you talk about the scene in the Waffle House. One of my favorite scenes of the year is the scene between Robert Redford and Casey Affleck in a bathroom.
In a bathroom, yeah.
You know, and it, that scene is so great. And that movie touches upon all the things that this movie talks about.
Yeah.
And it's so much better.
It's a much better movie.
People, wait to see The Old Man and the Gun, and I think you can kind of, see this one at your leisure.
Yeah. All right, guys, hang on. All right, Eric and Colin are going to hang on. We're going to take a break, come back. We've got a couple more movies to review. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the most popular holiday toys from the past 100 years and other holiday topics. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every week to review the new movies. Let's get them back in here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, you didn't see The Mule, correct?
I did not,
okay.
No.
All right. Well, let's move on here to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Colin, tell us about it.
Well, this is an animated film for the Marvel Universe, but it doesn't take place within any ongoing storyline that we already know. This is its own thing, and it's about a teenager named Miles Morales who goes through the motions of the Spider-Man origin story. He's a teenager. He gets bitten by a radioactive spider. But there's actually already a Spider-Man in his town. And everyone knows who he is. But then that Peter Parker / Spider-Man dies. And Miles, while trying to figure out what his powers are, meets another Spider-Man. And this one is middle-aged, has some weight gain on him, and a 5 o'clock shadow. But nevertheless, he ends up being Miles' mentor for all of this. And eventually more characters come into play for this Spider-Verse, including a noir Spider-Man, voiced by Nicolas Cage, a small pig in a Spidey suit named Spider-Ham, an anime girl with the robot companion, and a female spider woman as well. And they're all part of another
kind of dimension. And, you know, there's the usual comic book plot and within all of this about computer chips and closing off a dimension and saving the world and, you know, bad guy who wants to, you know, get Spider-Man and get this computer chip and blah, blah, blah. So there's all the usual comic book plot to go into this. But this is far from the usual Marvel movie. And as we said last week, I don't think any of us really expected much from this when we first heard about it. The last thing I need is another Spider-Man movie, although I've enjoyed some of them. I enjoyed the last one, The Homecoming. But this is number 7. This is our 7th Spider-Man. This is like the 3rd or 4th time telling another origin story, too. Luckily, this is the kind of movie that knows that and is very cheeky about origin stories and repeating origin stories. It's kind of a running gag in this movie about origin stories. It's very funny. This movie has 3 directors credited to it. And that sometimes can be a cause for concern if there's if some director maybe got kicked off or maybe there's a lot of disagreements or whatever. But 2 of these directors are making their debut here. One of them and the other one who's not made a movie called Rise of the Guardians, which was okay. But this is far from just okay. This is spectacular. This is, and I said this last week, and I'll say it again, this is every animation lover's dream, is this movie. It is so alive. There's so much color. There's and playfulness and different genres, different types of animation going throughout this thing. You see, like, photorealistic animation, your traditional computer generation. You see a little bit of Warner Brothers, some anime, and pop art, often existing in the same frame, and done in a way that is just like, you know, you just want to know more about the magician at work here that is making this really trippy, very stylistically bold animated movie that is never less than thrilling to watch and to look at. I never got tired of this movie like I do some other superhero movies, like I did one that's coming out soon. I never got tired of the characters. I loved all of them. I was invested in all of them. Even when the movie runs the risk of overflowing with too many characters, I can't imagine this movie without a single one of them. And like a lot of Marvel movies, I'm more invested in these characters than I am in the plot with the computer chip and the dimension and blah, blah, blah. But once that stuff actually comes into play, it's still fun to watch just for the animation and just watching the style of the animation change on a dime. And yet still it flows beautifully. And God, there are some funny gags in this movie. This is really one of the funniest films of the year. And, you know, it's probably no surprise because it's co-authored or co-produced by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the guys behind the Lego Movie and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. They got kicked off of Solo, and now I'm really mad about that because God knows what kind of movie they had in mind. But if it was anything like this, we really lost out. But this is, I never thought I was going to see a Spider-Man movie, let alone the animated Spider-Man movie, crack my top 10 list, but that's where this is at for me right now. I loved this movie. I can't wait to see it again, and I want everyone to go see it.
All right. Hang on, guys, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Colin are going to hang on, and when we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought and what I thought of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And then we've got the Monday morning movie reviews, which we're in the middle of right now. Let's get back to that. Eric Childress, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin Suter, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, what did you think of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse?
Yeah, it's really good. And I haven't reached quite the level of cynicism that Colin has with the whole comic book universe. But even I was saying when I heard that this project was announced that, you know, why do we need, I mean, how far is Sony going to run their one comic book property, you know, into the ground? You know, I mean, how many times are they going to reboot this one character? And, you know, especially when, you know, they got it right a number of times. But this movie is really just one of the complete surprises of the year. You know, I love the new characters. You know, and this is a movie that is not just all snark. This is a movie that could very easily, you know, fall into, you know, not the Lego movie was a trap at all, but, you know, Lego movie is a series of gags, one after another, very fast-paced, very manic. And, you know, this movie does kind of have that same sort of manic style that the Lego movie has at times. But this movie, you know, does have a heart to it. It really does believe in its characters. Even these characters that get introduced later in the film that are played, you know, for a lot of laughs throughout the movie, even they know when the, you know, situation requires a moment of clarity or a moment of concern, and where they have to, you know, actually feel for the Miles Morales character. And that's really refreshing in a movie like this. That, you know, even, you know, I always hated when, you know, like you watch I Love the 80s shows and, you know, someone's just always being snarky. You just wish they'd be serious about one topic once in a while. And that's how I felt during this movie. But it pulls it off, and it's really exciting at times. The voice work is stellar. I mean, Colin mentioned Nicolas Cage, and you know that's someone that I wish people didn't even know was in this movie going in, because when he starts, you know, doing his voice work, it's absolutely tremendous. But more people need to really be given props to Jake Johnson, who plays the newer the overweight middle-aged Peter Parker. He does fantastic voice work.
Yeah, he does.
In this film, he is great in it. There's a scene where he confronts someone at a dinner and is pretending to be a waiter. That is just fantastic. Just fantastic. It's manic, it's exciting. You only need, you know, unlike Mortal Engines, it only needs, you know, just a modicum of plotting to, you know, exactly, here's your MacGuffin, here's what they need, you go get it. The rest is character-driven. It's played for laughs. It's played for excitement. Please stay all the way to the end of the movie, because the laughs continue all the way till the end credits. This is a genuine surprise, and I'm really glad that that Sony continues to make good Spider-Man movies.
This was, you know, I don't know how many times we've used the word surprise, but this came out of nowhere, this movie. Like, when I first heard about it and I first saw the trailer, I was like, you gotta be kidding me, you know? A Spider-Man movie that's animated. How is this not going straight to DVD? That was what was going through my mind. And this thing, I saw it, by the way, I saw it in Navy Pier in IMAX in 3D. And if anybody can see, if you can see, it's unbelievable. Like, let me just say that. To see this thing in the IMAX 3D is just amazing. But yeah, this is one of the most fun and creative movies I've seen all year. The animation is spectacular. The voice work is great. It brings a whole fresh, you know, perspective to Spider-Man that in a completely different type of way. I mean, this is a genuinely surprising film on every level. And all that you mentioned it, Colin, every single time they introduce a new character and fly through the origin stuff cracked me up every time. I laughed every time at that. And there's some really some very exciting action sequences. I mean, and again, as you mentioned, Colin, I mean, the animation is so beautifully all over the place, and I mean that as a compliment. It just jumps off the screen. There's just so much excitement and so many unique things that are happening that I want to go back and see because I think I missed a few things. When certain things pop up on the screen, you're like, wait a minute, what was that? And the style of animation is so mixed up and beautiful. It is an incredibly well animated movie, and there's not one mutt frame in the movie that's not beautiful to look at. I was invested in the characters completely. I thought the father-son relationship was really strong and added a bit, and added a lot of emotion to it. Leading up to a scene near at the end where they have sort of this bonding moment, but they don't know it. You know what I mean? Which is a really funny way to handle it, a really beautiful way to handle it. This is a movie that just came out of nowhere, and everybody does great. Jake Johnson does great work, so does Haley Steinfeld. And Nicolas Cage, every single line that Nicolas Cage has is funny. It just totally cracked me up, and the whole perspective, and the kind of, because he plays the noir Spider-Man, so he's in black and he's in black and white, and he speaks in noir cliches, and it's wonderful. This is a really, really terrific movie, shockingly great, and again, one of the biggest surprises. We've used the word surprise now. All three of us have used the word surprise now 12 times, but that's just how incredibly surprising this movie turned out to be. I never, ever, ever expected to love an animated Spider-Man movie at this point. I just didn't, but it's great. It's great. And if you can see it in the IMAX 3D, it really does pop, man. I mean, it really is. It's pretty incredible. So I love this movie. I thought it was great.
Yeah. And when people do go see it, be sure to keep an eye whenever Spider-Man is flying through Times Square.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on everything that's on the marquees.
Oh, they're hilarious.
Oh, my Lord.
And that's what I'm saying. I know I missed a few of these things.
Yes.
What was the Shaun of the Dead one?
From Dusk Till Shaun.
Right, From Dusk Till Shaun.
There's also one involving Seth Rogen as a jockey.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's great stuff. Really, really. I mean, all the way across the board. This is just a pretty spectacular movie. So, all right. Well, guys, we're off for the next couple of weeks for the holidays. And then when we come back, we'll be back on January 7th. You guys will be down here live in the studio to do our year-end wrap-up.
Sounds great.
All right. Some of the other stuff that's coming out, I just want to mention really quickly, Welcome to Marwen opens up on Friday, and I'm hosting a screening of it at the AMC Rosemont 18 on Saturday night. So if people want to come out, I will be hosting the 7:10 screening of Welcome to Marwen.
Very cool.
And I
want to mention a movie called They Shall Not Grow Old, which is only playing as a Fathom event right now, tonight, and again on December 27th. It's a 3D movie comprised of World War I footage. It was made by Peter Jackson. It's one of the most stunning things I've ever seen, and people really need to see it in the theater in 3D while they can. I don't know why Warner Brothers and Fathom Events are only doing these little special screenings. It deserves better than that, but this is one I really feel strongly about that people should definitely go check out.
Okay. All right. That's tonight and December 27th.
Go to Fathom Events and look it up, and you'll get more information there about theaters and showtimes and all that. So.
All right, cool. All right, Colin, have a great Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year, and thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay. Eric, let's jump into the box office. Number one, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, $35.4 million. That's strong.
Yeah, it's a solid opening. I mean, compared to a lot of other superhero movies, comic book movies, it might seem low. But as animated films have kind of dominated the season, this is likely going to play very well into the holiday vacation and then some. So I think you're going to see this number is going to surprise people how far it actually gets.
I agree, because the word of mouth is going to be spectacular. I don't know. I mean, this movie is going to stick around for a long time, and it should, because it's really really good. Number two, The Mule, $17.2 million. That's more than I thought it would make.
It's about kind of what I was expecting it to do. I mean, I thought that, I actually thought this movie could actually do higher because they've been advertising it pretty well. It's actually the third best opening for a movie starring Clint Eastwood.
Is that right?
If you can believe that.
Wow.
Gran Torino and Space Cowboys opened higher.
Ah, okay.
Than that. But yeah, $17.2 million, the third highest opening for a movie starring Clint Eastwood.
Wow. All right. Number three, The Grinch, $11.5 million. It's that time of year, so obviously people are going to be going to see this thing.
Yeah, a real monster. It's still on a path for somewhere over $270 million. It's one of the big hits of the season.
Number four, Ralph Breaks the Internet, $9.5 million. It's up to $154.4 million. Is that about the same as the first one?
It's pretty much right on par with the first one. It's actually made as much as in its first 26 days as Bohemian Rhapsody did, which we're going to talk about in a second. Bohemian Rhapsody is $180 million right now, so it's going to get probably over $180 and probably get somewhere around $190. Whether it hits $200, we'll see, but it's definitely going. It should definitely hit what the original did, which was $189 million.
Yeah. Number five, wow, Mortal Engines, $7.5 million. I predicted that. I predicted that no one was going to care about this movie.
No, you're right, and I think people weren't even expecting it to do that low. I mean, the word all week was like, it could do under $20 million. And I was like, that seems pretty optimistic for this. You know, some people writing the headlines that it's the biggest bomb of the year. That's not entirely true. I mean, it's an abysmal opening for a $100 million production.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could still make a few bucks overseas. I wrote in my column today, I said that even if this movie made literally two cents this weekend, it still wouldn't be as big a bomb as A Wrinkle in Time and Solo were.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a loser. And it's kind of shows you how hard it is to launch one of these, you know, original fantasy pictures nowadays that's not geared, you know, directly towards kids and families.
And comic books, yeah.
And comic books, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Number six is Creed 2, $5.3 million. It's up to $104 million.
Yeah, should be passing the original film by next weekend.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then number seven, it just won't stop. Bohemian Rhapsody, $4.1 million, $180 million total.
Yeah, $609 million worldwide. It is the biggest moneymaker of the holiday season right now.
Is that unbelievable?
Yeah.
Could you imagine?
And probably headed now for a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, I know. It's insane. It's absolutely.
Because of the money.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
God, I hated that movie.
Garbage.
Number eight, Instant Family, $3.7 million, $60 million for your seasonal Mark Wahlberg family.
Sean Anders family
comedy.
Yeah.
Number nine, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, $3.6 million. It's up to $151 million, but it's doing really well overseas, correct?
Yeah, it's almost to $600 million worldwide. Still down from, you know, all the previous Harry Potter movies. So Warner Brothers is going to have to do a little bit of thinking, you know, if they're going to try and squeeze three more movies out of this.
Yeah. Number 10 is Green Book with $2.7 million. It's up to $24.6 million. I wish more people would see that.
Yeah, I mean, people are, you know, I mean, it hasn't been falling much over the last few weeks. You know, in the last 2 weeks, there was nothing really for it to fall from.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's weird to me that, like, First Man, for example, is a movie that disappointed the box office.
Yeah.
And now people are saying it is a dead fish, you know, going into the Oscars.
Yeah.
But Green Book, which has made, you know, much less, is a strong contender for Best Picture.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, that just kind of shows you, I don't know, the sort of the stigma that comes with disappointments in money, which is really just kind of shows you what a sham the Oscars really are.
Yeah. All right, well, Eric, have a great holiday, man, and I'll see you in the new year.
Thank you, man. You
too. All
right,
take care, buddy. All right, there you go. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN, and the guys will return for our year-end wrap-up with the best and worst movies of the year. They'll be live in studio on January 7th. All right, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN.